The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. The treatment industry in the United States is huge, by some estimates worth more than $40 billion annually and growing. It's not a well-regulated business. Fraud, abuse, and exploitation are rife. We're going to hear a little bit about that on today's show. Alexandra Planta is Director of Communications at the National Council for Mental Well-Being. She spoke recently on the subject of exploitation in a distress industry as part of a panel entitled Lack of Integrity and Transparency in Drug Treatment Services, Adverse Effects on Treatment Outcomes, and Infringement of Human Rights, which was held at NIDA's recent international forum.
So first off, this morning, I know we were talking about sort of what is corruption, what is abuse in terms of substance use disorder, treatment, and recovery. And another way to sort of thinking about corruption or abuse is that substance use disorder treatment is a distress industry. So what is a distress industry? It's a sector of services that typically serves populations under duress, stress, distress, and thus has a high potential for corruption and abuse, because we know that when humans are under stress or fear states, that really short circuits connections in the brain to the prefrontal cortex, which we know is pivotal or, you know, critical to making not only all the executive functioning in the body, but also for decision making. So classic distress industries are examples of distress industries. There are a few others that we can talk about here. So there are locksmiths. You're locked out of your house and that's not a good feeling. And you need somebody to come help let you in, or also maybe potentially to your car. Another industry that sort of sees a higher incidence of distress could be online pharmacies. So to really dig in today to substance use disorder as a distress industry, I wanted to go through six forms of a very prominent corruption that we have seen in the substance use disorder treatment realm. The first three that we're going to talk about, I think, have been addressed more comprehensively than the last three, and we will talk about that. But the first one I wanted to talk about is patient brokering. And this can take several forms. The first form it can take is lead selling, which involves paying brokers a finder fee or a kickback for referring patients to their treatment facility. So an example of this is that you give a patient or you give a referring party $500 to $1,000 per patient to get them in the door. And this is happening not only with patients new to treatment, but also between recovery residences and treatment centers, or between two separate research treatment centers. I apologize. Another form for patient brokering is lead buying. And lead buying historically has been call centers. So what that looks like is you're probably in a state of panic or urgency. You're trying to find substance use disorder treatment for yourself or a loved one. And so you go online, you call phone number 1-800-RECOVERY, and you actually get sent to a call center, which potentially could reroute your call to any number of treatment centers within a referral network across the United States. So call centers were very prominent, especially 5+ years ago, and they would generate a commission based on the number of placed referrals. We also saw call center agents posing as caregivers, and, you know, unbeknownst to the patient, they would auction them off to the highest bidding treatment center. And a lot of the bidding had to do with what kind of insurance carrier. Was it private pay versus Medicare, Medicaid? In terms of what the bidding price of the patient would be. So, and then I think the last thing here is just that treatment centers that may have appeared as separate centers would all actually route to the same call center. So you just had these like webs online of referral networks. And then the last piece here is just addiction tourism. So addiction tourism is the practice of sending individuals to an addiction treatment center that is not in their home state. And so one of our cohort today, Alan, is from the Florida Shuffle. And Florida, as well as California and Arizona, were big hotspots in the United States for addiction tourism, where you're selling palm trees and addiction treatment. So the second one here is list hijacking. And what this has to do with is that in Google Business or Google Maps, listings can be altered, or they used to be able to be altered through the suggested edits feature. So basically, anyone could go into an organization's profile and actually change the listed phone number. So people were going into other addiction treatment centers, you know, pop up and ads on Google and Google Maps, and actually putting in their call center number, so that when you thought you were calling, Gosnold on the Cape, and you're actually getting, you know, Palm Beach Recovery. So, and then the last one that I think has been addressed to some extent, but it's patient enticement. And so that's providing unethical incentives to get patients to enter, to stay, to switch addiction treatment facilities. And so the forms that this took was often just money, gifts of any kind. In the recovery housing space, we saw free rent. In the addiction treatment space, we saw flights, we saw food, we saw other amenities. And it is illegal. Now, starting here, these are ones that have not, I believe, you know, are forms of corruption that have not fully been addressed. But insurance billing and fraud is exactly what it sounds like. It's the process of billing insurance companies excessively for unnecessary treatment or services. And an example that we're going to see is in urine drug screens. So, for example, 10 drug tests are performed every 2 days and are billed at $1,000. So under the guise of free insurance or care, people recording more drug tests than were actually taken, or recording more panels than were actually conducted. It's just an easy way to slip in additional funds to insurance companies. Another example is that under the guise, like you call a call center and they say, you know, you can have free insurance or care to patients. The addiction treatment center, there were a few that were actually enrolling patients into insurance for them, either utilizing false addresses to take advantage of like the change in address exception, which allows a person to get coverage outside of the open enrollment period. But also, you know, enrolling patients without their knowledge into premium private plans with generous coverage so that the treatment center gets reimbursed at a higher rate than that of other plans. So by the treatment center fronting, you know, the $500 to $1,000 to enroll in the private plan, they were then able to get $30,000 or $40,000 on the back end for the treatment. Patient privacy violations. I bring this up because we all know about HIPAA. We all know it's a thing. You can't share patients' personal information. This is especially critical in substance use disorder because there's such a high level of stigma that when there are breaches in patient privacy, it can set patients up for loss of employment, inability to get employment, and other consequences. Lastly, misleading language or misrepresentation of services. This somewhat goes with the other ones, but it's facilities misrepresenting locations, amenities, patient outcomes in various ways. So we used to see one of the ways we would see this is we used to see a lack of denial of affiliation to other facilities. So that was when you called the call center, they wouldn't say it was a call center. They wouldn't reveal or have transparency into the network, into the referral system. But today, in terms of corruption, what we mostly see is inaccurate portrayal of services. An example is equine therapy, or having pictures of like horseback riding or fun activities on the website that don't actually exist. Or another one would be claiming that they have a specialty program or treat special conditions like comorbidity, trauma, or for example, our LGBTQ plus friendly or elderly, you know, geriatric population friendly, when they really don't have those specialty programs in place. And then the last one is just in terms of accepted insurances. And I'm just very quickly going to roll this all together an example, but because there were gaps in federal and state regulation of these corrupt, unethical addiction marketing practices, it actually led to, in 2015, 2016, Google Ads teaming up with LegitScript, both private for-profit entities, to start to patrol the Google Ads space online. The pros of this partnership was there was a decrease in some forms of corruption, such as list hijacking and patient brokering. However, the limitations of a private for-profit partnership is that you now have a non-expert for-profit entity setting health industry treatment standards. Additionally, the certification process at LegitScript, it's a lot of time, it's very expensive, which may not be a hurdle for some for-profit treatment centers, but can be a big hurdle for, you know, public treatment centers that may not have the funding. And the last thing I will just say is it's an imperfect system, because as researchers, if we want to conduct any kind of patient recruitment online, there's no certification process for us to go through to use the keywords like addiction or substance use or treatment in study recruitment marketing. Our ads would get taken down.
Okay, no, you're here, okay?
I think we got somebody off mute. Let's see. So in conclusion, I just kind of wanted to do a quick wrap up and call to action, but we need more corruption research to identify the prevalence. And the key here is that we need to quantify the corruption that still exists. Stuff has been done. I can say kind of just speaking for myself, you know, that like call centers are less than they used to be, but we don't have numbers to actually quantify and solidify progress or what corruption still exists. We need more research to identify the gaps in regulation for federal, state, medical bodies to fill. And lastly, we need standardization and ongoing monitoring and evaluation of addiction treatment delivery to ensure that there is a quality of care for a vulnerable population like addiction treatment patients, and so that these decisions do not fall to private industry.
That was Alexandra Planta, Director of Communications at the National Council for Mental Well-Being. She spoke recently on the subject of exploitation in the distress industry as part of a panel entitled Lack of Integrity and Transparency in Drug Treatment Services, Adverse Effects on Treatment Outcomes and Infringement of Human Rights, which was held at NIDA's recent international forum. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Another of speakers on that panel was Dr. Carmen Albizu. Professor Carmen Albizu, MD, is professor in the Evaluation and Evaluation Research Master's Program at the Graduate School of Public Health Medical Sciences Campus of the University of Puerto Rico, and a funded researcher in the institution's Center for Evaluation and Sociomedical Research.
We will be talking about structural factors endangering human rights of persons with an opioid use disorder in Puerto Rico. I want to recognize the co-author of the report on which this presentation is based, Professor Oscar Miranda Miller from the UPR School of Law. Next, please. And the study in which this presentation is based is entitled Vulnerability in Persons with Addiction Disorders in Puerto Rico and Its Relationship with Human Trafficking. It was supported by Open Society's Foundation. The study was approved by the Institutional Review Board of our Medical Sciences campus, and we do not have conflict of interest to disclose. Next, please. In 2014, during the ATOT conference convened in Philadelphia, we encountered a cover article in the local Spanish press related to the lives of quote-unquote zombies living under a highway bridge. Nearly 200 men, mostly Puerto Rican, with a drug use problem and a history of having been transported from the island for supposed treatment in Philadelphia. As a result, the Puerto Rico Mental Health and Addiction Services Administration disseminated public information recognizing the large treatment gap in the island and efforts underway to address this. In the meantime, they encouraged anyone seeking treatment in a U.S. city to contact our 24-hour helpline for information on licensure status and other qualifications at the facility in which they were seeking care. In 2017, the local press began coverage of similar phenomena in other U.S. cities, and through the Puerto Rico Civil Rights Commission, a group was convened to explore this phenomenon. Persons being transferred were mostly men with an opioid use disorder without homes. We were able to get secure funding from Open Societies to conduct this qualitative study. The next one, please. With interviews to 20 persons in New York City and Puerto Rico who had experienced relocation, interviews to key informants at both sites, and reviews of related documents from state government, other organizations, and press articles. We will be sharing findings from our report in the interest mostly to raise attention to the likelihood of occurrence in other U.S. jurisdictions and countries experiencing a large treatment gap in availability of effective treatment for opioid use disorders. Next one, please. In this slide, we present the some of the characteristics of the 20 interviewed participants that had been transferred to the United States. We want to emphasize that they were mostly male. Obviously, this is not a representative sample, but this reflects the prevalence of opioid use disorders among Puerto Ricans by sex. At the time of the interview, they range from 30 to 60 plus years. And I wanted to underscore that 65% of them had a history of at least one incarceration and even more. Even though the Puerto Rico Department of Corrections initiated pre-release methadone maintenance treatment in 2002, the capacity of this program was minimal compared to need, with nearly 59% of persons in prisons fulfilling diagnosis for a drug use disorder. The majority had not received treatment in the community prior to incarceration, and those that reported any involvement with community health services had only received detox. The next one, please. As we see in this slide, the persons interviewed reported transfers originating as far back as 1994 and as recent as 2018. So this had been transpiring for 24 years under the public radar. Next one, please. Now, the initiations of transfers coincide with an increase in the gap between demand and supply of substance use disorder treatment in Puerto Rico, particularly for opioid use disorders. In the 90s, methadone maintenance treatment, we had 14 treatment centers in Puerto Rico, experienced a nearly 800 reduction in capacity. In fact, in that decade, Puerto Rico saw, for the first time, a threefold increase in overdose deaths from opioids. A 2002 study of treatment availability for drug use disorders reported a gap of 92%, and the predominant services were abstinence-based long-term residential facilities with very poor retention. The presence of persons with an opioid use disorder in public spaces were considered dangerous and a public nuisance. And this led to representatives from quote-unquote treatment facilities in U.S. cities address city mayors with options for transfers, leading to the recruitment of persons through deception and lack of accountability. Next one, please. In this slide, we observe that as occurs across the U.S., where in a 2021 blog by Dr. Nora Bolkov, she reported that the capacity to treat opioid use disorders at that time in the United States was 18%. We observed that We also in Puerto Rico have been experiencing a large gap for persons with an opioid use disorder. In the latest census, the population census in 2016-17, only 3 out of 10 people with a diagnosis had received any services to maturity detox for their condition during the previous 12 months. The next one, please. When we assess the modalities of Puerto Rico licensed programs in 2021, the most restrictive level of care is what predominates. In this slide, we can see that out of 200 facilities that were licensed for substance use disorder treatment, long-term residential treatment comprised 102. These are run basically by persons in recovery without any professional staffing. And even though there has been an increase since 2002 of the census for methadone maintenance treatment and an increase in the access to buprenorphine, this is really still much below the need for care. The next one, please. Nearly half of residential treatments are provided by an industry called Hogares Crea. Hogares Crea is an abstinence-based long-term residential treatment facility in Puerto Rico, other Caribbean and Central American countries, Colombia, Venezuela, and Florida. And I don't know, Alan, if you've had any contact with them there. But they basically depart from the perception that they are a community for character re-education and for re-socializing and rehumanizing individuals. They are apply confrontational therapy that is known to cause harm and be ineffective. That includes shaming, harassment, and punishment in their attempts to re-socialize individuals with a failed personality. When we hear responses from three of our participants when asked about experiences with treatment in Puerto Rico, one of them said, hey, negative, in Puerto Rico, treatment is very scarce. Another indicates that when he was young, he never received any treatment, and another that he was in Hogar Crea. Next one, please. Surprisingly, in addition to individuals without homes, recruitment for transfers were carried out in the city of Bayamón's opioid treatment program. And this is the story of one individual who was recruited with the assumptions that he would get better care and better opportunities for social integration. He arrived at a treatment program in Chicago with dilapidated premises, abstinence-oriented, managed by peers, no methadone, and he encountered other residents similarly recruited from among patients in the same Bayamón clinic. Next one, please. Elements suggestive of human trafficking, the experience of a female transferred to a New York City program in the vicinity of Times Square. She was withdrawn from her opioid problem without medical assistance. After 3 weeks, she was taken to apply for state benefits, subsequently told that treatment was completed and that she could be returned to Puerto Rico, but only if she promised not to return to New York in 5 years. We had to search out to see why this was the condition for her return to Puerto Rico, and it turns out that the maximum number of years in life in your lifetime that you can actually receive state benefits is 5 years. The next one, please. The mayors in cities construed the presence of persons with an untreated OUD and as a really public nuisance. And this is reflected in an interview reported by a newspaper article from Philadelphia in which a Philadelphia assemblywoman meets with the mayor of one of our cities and asked him if it was fair that not taking care of a situation in his country, another city government had to bear the weight. And he replied simply that he had addicts hanging around and had to clean up his city. And this mayor, throughout his tenure, paid with city funds for transfers of persons to the U.S. Next one, please. The police in Puerto Rico, the state police, contributed through a program called Return to Life, providing transportation for persons recruited for transfer to the airport. Only between 2005 and 2014, and remember that this phenomenon began much earlier, they had transferred 759 persons who ended up living in precarious conditions. The next one, please. In all the narratives, there are certain commonalities. None of the interviewees express having encountered positive experiences. They faced unacceptable conditions of vulnerability that risked their physical, emotional, economic, and social health, and all shared perceptions of having been deceived. The next one. None of the experience lent credence to the perception that socially marginalized people with a substance use disorder are perceived as dangerous. And these transfers were managed by municipal governments, religious groups, family members, or combinations. And the participants' testimonies are validated by the volume of information disseminated through the U.S. press that we cite in our report and testimonies of key enforcement at both cities. Next one, please. Now, the underlying paradigm that sustains prohibition is a significant contributor to the construction of persons with a drug use disorder as basically evil and untrustworthy. Nearly 60 years ago, policy was adopted under the following premises, as seen here from the preamble of the UN Single Convention on Narcotic Drugs convened by the United States, that have contributed to policy decisions based on the assumptions that drug users don't want treatment, that they lie, and that, as the DEA has suggested in a document on pain management, we need to be aware of their scams. The next one, please. In conclusion, as long as we persist on limiting access to evidence-based care respectful of patients' rights and construct persons with an opioid use disorder as untrustworthy, we set them up for failure and unsuccessful social integration. This then reinforces stigma and policy, because what we see is people that, A, are not staying in treatment, which we assume has to do that they don't want treatment, they don't want services, and they're not willing to change. And this facilitates opportunistic predatory abuses in the name of treatment. So I would conclude indicating that our challenges, we have to deconstruct stereotypes and how they feed into the structural policy, regulatory factors, and other discriminatory activities that take place in our communities, particularly in the U.S. and Puerto Rico, that also contribute to our overdose epidemic, and that are responsive to stigma that hinders availability on demand of effective treatment. We need to professionalize services, we need to decriminalize and increase the supply of interventions supported by science and respectful of human rights.
That was Professor Carmen Albizu, MD, professor in the Evaluation and Evaluation Research Master's Program at the Graduate School of Public Health, the Medical Sciences Campus at the University of Puerto Rico, and a funded researcher in the institution's Center for Evaluation and Sociomedical Research. She was speaking at NIDA's recent international forum on a panel entitled Lack of Integrity and Transparency in Drug Treatment Services, Adverse Effects on Treatment Outcomes and Infringement of Human Rights. NIDA's International Forum was held June 9th and 10th. Now, videos of both days of that event have not been publicly posted, and as far as I can tell, will not be. It is possible to access those videos, at least up until early December of this year. You'll have to register for the conference to get access. Registration is still open, and it's free. You can find a link to register for access to NIDA's International Forum via the NIDA website. Go to nida.nih.gov/international/meetings, and then follow the links to get to NIDA's International Forum. And for now, that's it. Thank you for joining us. This has been Century of Lies. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. Find this edition of Century along with an archive of past shows at the Drug Truth Network website, drugtruth.net. You'll find a link there to subscribe to the Century of Lies podcast. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Doug McVeigh. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy reform and the failed war on drugs. For now, this is Doug McVeigh
saying
so long.
For the Drug Truth Network,
this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the century of lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.